Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We are simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. Retune your radio dials and let us know how the signal is on 101.1. Later on in the show, we're going to be speaking to Steve Jimenez about his television program that he co-produced for Dan Rather called Did Texas Execute Innocent Men? And we're also going to be talking about the upcoming performance of Dear Diary. Right now, by telephone, I would like to welcome Jake Norton. He is a mountain guide, Himalayan expert, and photographer, and he will be tonight at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art at 107 East Palace Avenue, right here in downtown Santa Fe, at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Mountain Institute and in conjunction with the press at the Palace of the Governors. He joins us now by telephone in transit to Santa Fe. Welcome, Jake Norton.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.
Your talk tonight is titled, It's Not About the Top, A New Perspective on Everest and Himalayan Culture. And this is sort of a surprising sentiment from somebody who's reached the summit of Mount Everest twice in consecutive years. You are a climber. What do you mean by it's not about the top?
Well, I think, that's a very interesting issue. For me, summits, of course, are important. They set the stage for an entire climbing endeavor and a passage of exploration, as I see it, personal exploration and physical. But I think we tend to emphasize summits far too much. And in my experience, the summit of Everest and summits of many mountains, while on the one hand quite wonderful and quite enjoyable, are really just one small part of a much greater journey, to use that cliche. But cliches are around because they contain some truth, and I think that's the truth of this one, that the summits of mountains really are just one small part of the greater experience. And what I've found over my time in the Himalaya especially is that the mountains are more than anything a incredible backdrop to an even more fascinating and incredible mosaic and tapestry of cultures and peoples and beliefs and environments, and that's where the real interest is in my book.
Tell us about that journey. I mean, it's, as you say, it's about the people and the cultures. You speak Nepali. You've gotten immersed in various aspects of Himalayan culture. What was it that drew you to the people part of that area of the world?
You know, it was actually my first trip over there when I was a senior in high school. I went over ostensibly to climb and trek. The only thing I really knew about Nepal at that time was that it had some really big mountains in it, and I was a budding climber. Got over there, and I remember vividly from the moment we touched down in Kathmandu, it for the first time honestly dawned on me that there were actually these people living at the base of these mountains and making their lives day in and day out within the spectacular mountain environment. And immediately I was intrigued. I wanted to know what made them click. How did they think about the world around them? How did the mountains influence them? And what I found over that time, and then later on going back to study in Nepal and write my thesis there, was just an amazing culture of people that in many ways think and believe many of the same things we do. They want the same things for themselves and their families, and yet have a contentment that I think at times we lack in the Western world. They have very little and yet manage to be quite content with what they have, and by and large are very pleasant, peaceful people, very happy people, and have always touched my heart, and that's something that that I find very grounding whenever I'm over there.
What are some aspects of the cultures that you've immersed yourself in that are really influenced by the mountains? I mean, what makes these people mountain people?
Well, I think, of course, physically, they grow up, they're born in the mountains. A lot of Nepalis are, not all. Nepal is an incredibly diverse place, both ethnically and geographically. It goes from the Indo-Gangetic Plains in the south to just 150 miles north of that, the crest of the Great Himalaya. But a good percentage of the population does grow up in the foothills of the Himalaya. And what I've found, mountain people all around the world, I think, tend to be very in tune with their natural environment. The environment around them forces them to be such. They can't be lackadaisical about it. They have to pay attention and know the environment, and they're very respecting of it as well. And also, I think, respecting of other people visiting that environment. They tend to be very welcome and open towards guests and visitors in their areas.
What do they think of these people coming in by droves all year round and climbing up these crazy difficult mountains?
Well, I think to some extent they think we're a little bit batty. That's maybe changed in recent years, but back in the old days, when the pioneer climbers were first going into the high mountains back in the 20s and 30s, Tenzin Norgay, the great Sherpa climber who almost made the summit of Everest in 52 and then made it with Hillary in 53 the following year, he grew up actually in Tibet and remembered seeing the early British climbers coming in and thought that they were a group of madmen going to traipse up these high mountain peaks, the abode of the gods, which is what Himalaya means in Sanskrit. And over time, that attitude is still hung in there a little bit. People, I think, can't quite fathom why we would choose to go and climb the high Himalayan peaks for our vacation or our avocation, but they gladly go up. Many of the Sherpa and other tribes that climb in the Himalaya now do that as a profession. And the interesting component to me is when you ask one of the Sherpa, well, do you hope that that your children will one day grow up to climb Mount Everest, they usually look at me like I have two heads, and they say, no, are you crazy? Of course not. I'm working this hard in the mountains so that I can send my children to private school in Kathmandu so they never have to put a backpack on in their lives.
It's so interesting because you give inspirational talks and motivational keynote addresses and things like that in which the mountain is the metaphor for other mountains in our lives that are maybe non-physical and so on.
Right.
I think it's, you know, I've always wondered about that mountain as metaphor thing, and here you are in the area of mountains confronted with a people who don't have that mountain climbing metaphor as the great achievement.
Right. Yeah, I think by and large, and I hate to generalize too much, but the Nepali people tend to have a slightly different perspective on things. Some are very success oriented, but there's less of the Western variety of A-type, super goal-oriented personalities, which I think can be both a blessing and a curse. It can be a blessing because people tend to enjoy the moment a lot more than maybe on average we do in the West. You'll see people very, very content sitting around with their family and not thinking about the next big task on their agenda. I think the drawback to that can be, at times, a fatalistic attitude towards progress, which has maybe stunted things a little bit. But to me, finding solace in that attitude has really been a big moving point of my life, and that's something that the positive aspects of it that I try and convey in my presentations and using the mountain and the journey as a metaphor.
What is the nature of the religion, the local religion, in which the mountain gods are up on top of the mountains?
Well, you actually have two. Nepal, again, is a very diverse place. The predominant religions there are Hinduism, coming in from India, and Buddhism, which migrated to Nepal over 1,000 years ago. And those are the two dominant religions now. It depends on who you ask, who says which religion is the majority. I'd say they're about equal, probably all in all, in Nepal. And both consider the mountains to be the home of the gods, the realm of the deities. And in fact, Mount Kailash, sacred Mount Kailash up in Tibet, is probably the holiest mountain anywhere in the world. It's revered by somewhere in the ballpark of 1 billion people, Hindus and Buddhists, as an incredibly sacred pilgrimage ground. And Everest, interestingly, even though to us it's the highest mountain on earth, it's sacred and revered, it hasn't held that same cachet in the Hindu Buddhist pantheon and sphere for for very long. It actually is a sacred peak, but was never considered quite as sacred as many of the others, mainly because it wasn't a place where a lot of people lived, and from the south side in Nepal, people couldn't identify it very easily as the highest mountain. So there were other ones that were far more sacred.
We're talking to Jake Norton, and he will be in Santa Fe tonight at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art at 6 o'clock. You've also climbed in the high Andes in South America. Do you see parallels in the cultures of these two highland people?
Yes, I do, definitely. You know, the general attitude towards life and land and outsiders coming into their countryside and terrain, I definitely see that mirrored in the Quechua people of the Peruvian Andes, where I've climbed mostly in South America. And there's actually a wonderful book that was written probably 15 years ago now by, I believe it was Andrew Gold, called Circle of the Spirit. And it was he was a geographic anthropologist looking at the similarities between the Navajo and the Tibetans, and talking about how geography shapes worldviews and theological worldviews, and how not through the Bering Strait land bridge, but actually through simply geography and the climates they grew up in or evolved in, rather, the Navajo and the Tibetans have developed a very similar worldview and theological worldview.
And the same goes for the Quechua people of the Andes, you're saying?
Yeah, I would say the same thing holds true by and large. They really tend to view the world in similar ways.
So, you are also a photographer. Do you always have photographic equipment with you when you're climbing in the mountains?
Yeah, for better or worse, I do. I tend to, much to my wife's chagrin at times when we're checking onto a plane, I usually have too much gear with me, and photo gear and climbing gear and duffel bags worth of junk.
I was asking that because I wondered what it was like to climb a mountain with photographic equipment versus without it, whether it was a different experience.
Yeah, you know, it definitely adds an additional element of tension and difficulty and surprise to it. When I'm shooting an assignment, say, on Everest, which I've been fortunate enough to do on a few occasions, you know, it throws the element in of you always have to be in front of the climbers, but of course they pass you as you're taking photos or video footage of them, so you're constantly playing a leapfrog game where you're jumping in front of them, trying to get up ahead, giving yourself enough time to find a good space to set up and put together pictures, take the pictures, and then turn around and pack your gear back up and then leapfrog them once more. And so it's quite a difficult situation in many, many cases.
You've also done, you've done so much climbing that you actually found the remains of one of the early British climbers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That was actually my first Everest expedition. It was in 1999, and our goal of that expedition was a little bit unique. We weren't going to the mountain that year to try and stand on top of it, but instead to step back in time, back 75 years to June 8th, 1924, and figure out what happened to two men, Andrew Irvine and George Mallory, on that day, when they disappeared at about 1 in the afternoon, less than 1,000 feet from the top of Everest.
And so how did you go about reconstructing that journey?
Well, you know, it was based on very little evidence, and we somehow managed to get enough sponsor money together. Basically, there were three clues before we set off in 99 to the mountain, and they had all come years before. There was the final sighting of Mallory and Irvine. There was Irvine's ice axe found in 1933 on the ridgecrest. And then in 1975, a Chinese climber had found what he described as an English dead high on the mountain. And using that information, our historian, Jochen Hemleb from Germany, also using the work of previous historians, notably Tom Holzell back in Boston, was able to identify a basin high on the north face of Mount Everest that seemed to hold the most promise for finding evidence of Mallory and Irvine. And then whether I dare say it or not, we had a lot of blind, dumb luck, which is an essential component to success on Everest. We happened to hit it that year in the driest year ever recorded in the Himalayas, so there was very little winter snow to conceal the artifacts we were looking for, and our teammate Conrad Anker was walking at about 27,000 feet in the basin as we were all searching one day, and happened to stop in the right place at the right time and happened to glance over his left shoulder and saw what turned out to be Mallory's foot sticking out of the rubble.
Unbelievable.
It was an unbelievable day. It was, I still honestly get goosebumps to this day remembering it and the time we spent with him, and just to me how overwhelmingly humbling it was to be standing there in a $1,000 down suit and $1,000 boots, waddling around like a Michelin man, standing over the remains of a guy who had walked at least that high 75 years before, dressed in a cotton shirt and a tweed coat.
I was looking at some of those pictures of the early climbers, and you just can't even imagine that they survived just in their outfits.
Yeah, really, anytime I find that my ego is getting the best of me, all I have to do is either think about the Sherpa and their strength and skill, or think about Mallory and Irvine and Norton and Somerville and the early pioneers, and I'm immediately put to shame and humbled.
When you think about what their lives were like, do you think that, how do I say this, that they were okay about dying on the mountain? I mean, that was the way they lived. Do you think when you project yourself into that, do you think that would be the worst possible way to die, given or the best?
You know, I think the worst possible way. I think if I were given the choice to say that I was going to die tomorrow, and I had the option of getting hit on Interstate 25 by a semi or dying on Everest, I'd probably choose Everest. But for all intents and purposes, without the outcome known, I would ultimately prefer to die in my bed at age 90 and having lived a good life with no regrets. And I think, you know, Mallory and Irvine, I think they felt that way too, especially Mallory. Irvine was fairly young. It was his first time to the Himalaya. He was only 22 years old, but Mallory was a Himalayan veteran. He had also... he was a veteran of World War One, had served in the front lines, and had a family, had three children, and a wife that he was very much in love with. And I don't think that he wanted to die in the mountains. I don't think he was anticipating that, although he might have had some foreboding moments. But I think what happened, unfortunately, was he, and as a result, Irvine got obsessed by reaching the summit and made poor decisions. And I think that's a scenario that we still see played out every year on Mount Everest, as people get obsessed with that little patch of snow on top and to some extent throw caution to the wind to get there.
We're talking to Jake Norton. What is the experience of being in your body like at 27,000 feet?
It's a very interesting one. What I try and tell people, or often tell people to simulate altitude, is stand up, run in place as hard as you can for about a minute with one of those stir straws in your mouth that you stir your coffee with, and try and breathe normally through that straw. And that's about what it feels like on the summit ridge. No matter what you do, you just simply cannot catch your breath. And you recover very slowly. You'll have a hard day's work up on the mountain, and the next day you feel like you got very drunk the night before. It's kind of a hangover type feeling, and it's pretty brutal, pretty grueling on the body. The one benefit for me, at least, is they're finding now that whether you do well or not at high altitude is largely a factor of genetics, and it comes down in layman's terms to a pH balance in your blood that dictates your respiratory drive. And fortunately for me, I must have the right pH balance, because I do fairly well at altitude, and I guess it's just a genetic luck of the draw, but it's nonetheless a very difficult environment to spend a lot of quality time in.
You were talking earlier on about one of the qualities of the Nepali people whom you've met, who are mountain people who live around the base of Mount Everest and places like that, is that they're really in tune with their environment. Have you learned to be in tune with your environment in the way that they do it, and that helps you on the mountain?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I watched the Sherpa up there, and they're... you know, they have, I think, a much healthier attitude towards things that happen in, you know, we're more inclined, if I remember specifically in 2003, we were on the mountain, and a huge windstorm rolled in and just wreaked havoc, destroyed our camps. It was 120, 130 mile an hour winds high on the mountain. All of our hard work and effort, and a lot of that work was done by the Sherpa, was laid to waste over the period of a few days. And I think in the West, often our reaction to that is one of frustration and throw up our hands and say, "Oh, that's crazy. I can't believe that just happened. That's not fair," so on and so forth. But you watch the Sherpa, and they may be a little bit frustrated, but they don't let it get to them quite as much. By and large, they react calmly and think, well, you know, as the saying goes in Nepal, "Ke garne," what to do. You throw up your hands and you pick up and you deal with it and you put the pieces back together and you take it one step at a time. And I think that's something that I can definitely work on in my life, especially as I'm sitting in rush hour traffic and just throw up my hands and say, well, there's not much I can do about it. Just smile and enjoy.
What's the scariest moment you ever experienced mountain climbing?
What is the scariest? There's been quite a few, I think, as is inevitable in the sport. Probably the closest I've ever come to buying the farm, so to speak, was climbing in Smith Rocks in Oregon, where I made a stupid error. I was rappelling down off a climb called the Monkey's Face and wasn't paying attention and lost my brake hand on a single strand of rope and started free-falling. I was looking at about a 300-foot fall down to a not-so-good landing, and luckily had the presence of mind to, with about 12 feet of rope left, grab onto the rope barehanded and stop myself. I ended up burning my hands down to the bone, but at least came away alive. So that that was probably the scariest moment I've had.
I'm terrified just sitting here in the cafe. Jake Norton is a mountain guide, Himalayan expert, and photographer, and he will be in Santa Fe tonight at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. That's at 6 o'clock, downtown Santa Fe. It's 107 East Palace Avenue, sponsored by the Mountain Institute and in conjunction with the press at the Palace of the Governors. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us, and we look forward to seeing you in Santa Fe tonight.
Thank you. Likewise, I'll look forward to it.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Steve Jimenez. Well, stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Steve Jimenez. He joins us here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. He's a journalist and producer, and he produced a program on television with Dan Rather called Did Texas Execute Innocent Men, which is on HDTV, which I guess is a cable channel.
Yes, it's HD Net is the actual broadcaster, and it is on cable. I believe here locally you can get it on DirecTV or Dish Network.
So this is a program basically about Texas, about the death penalty, about people who were executed who may have been innocent. Tell us about these two cases of the young men in Texas whose guilt is now called into question.
Sure. First of all, I've been wanting to do something on the death penalty for a while, and of course Texas is a likely place to look at the death penalty, given that Texas has executed more than one-third of all the executions that have taken place since the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. The two cases that we looked at are particularly interesting because both of them depended largely on eyewitness testimony. And in both cases, in one in particular, the principal eyewitness, actually the only eyewitness, recanted his testimony recently, saying that the person he had identified, that he really was never sure and that he had been pressured by police. In the second case, there was more than one witness, but they actually didn't witness the crime. But in that case, one of the witnesses also said years later that he was not sure. And that he, too, had been convinced by police. So, you know, you have two cases here where men were executed on very thin evidence. There was no physical evidence linking either man to the crime. And so they were particularly strong cases to look at.
One of them was a minor. He was 17 years old. How is it possible that he was executed?
Well, this crime took place in the 1980s, Mary Charlotte. And at that time, people that had committed crimes while they were minors could be executed. The Supreme Court changed that, and it's no longer possible for, individuals who were minors at the time they committed the crime to be executed, but at that time it was possible. And, you know, this was the 1980s in San Antonio where there was a lot of crime being committed by young people, and, you know, there was a feeling that people that committed particularly violent crime should be treated as adults.
One of the things that I was struck while watching this, and by the way, this program, Did Texas Execute Innocent Men, is available online. You can watch it if you don't have a cable TV, but you do have access to a computer. One of the things I was really struck by is that these young men were not Boy Scouts by any means. They were people with pretty rough situations, but when you hear the story, they were not... It looks very much like they did not do what they were accused of doing in terms of the capital crime that got them executed. Do judges, do police have, do you think, trouble dealing with making differentiations between one crime and another when they're confronted with a rough young man?
Yes. In both of these cases, as you noted, both of these young men, you know, had... you know, prior records. Well, Ruben Cantu, the younger one, the young man who was 17, had no previous convictions, but, you know, it was well known that he was involved in stealing cars and other illegal activities. The other fellow, Carlos de Luna, also had a previous record, in fact, of some convictions, but nothing that would indicate that he would be capable of committing a violent crime like this. So naturally, they were targets. The police, you know, were after these guys, and I can understand why the police might come to the conclusion that they might have done it. But again, the evidence was very thin. And, you know, of course, with the irreversibility of the death penalty, what you have here is years later, you go back and look at some of the specifics of the case and find out that witnesses who apparently were clear at the time were never that clear.
And were pressured by the police, saying, we're bringing your man in, here he is. Is that him? Which, of course, is very much leading the witness.
Yes, absolutely. Again, you know, the thing that really drew me in was the fact that there was no physical evidence. DNA evidence was not being used at that time. The technology did not exist. But, you know, the blood evidence in the second case, Carlos de Luna, you know, there was ample blood evidence, but the police were so certain that de Luna was their guy that, you know, the evidence wasn't analyzed.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about that case, which was a murder of a convenience store clerk, was that the convenience store clerk, her bloody body was dragged by the murderer from one place to another within the store, and the man they arrested had no blood anywhere on his body or his clothing.
There was none. And one of the interesting things about that case is that the prosecutor argued that a robbery had taken place. And in the course of our investigation, and also an investigation done by the Chicago Tribune, it was found that the man who came to the store, a manager, later to count, you know, what was in the cash register, found that that no robbery had taken place, and the police never spoke to this man. The prosecutor never spoke to this man. The defense attorney never spoke to this man, and yet the prosecutor argued before the jury that a robbery had taken place. One other thing that's really notable here is that in the case of de Luna, what it appears to have been was a case of mistaken identity, where another man by the name of Carlos Hernandez, someone who had a long record, particularly of knife crimes against women,
which is what this crime was,
exactly, that the police and one of the prosecutors was aware of this other individual, and yet the prosecutor got before the jury and said the other man is a phantom.
So Carlos de Luna defended himself by saying, look, I didn't do it, Carlos Hernandez did it, and the prosecutors, who knew perfectly well that Carlos Hernandez existed and had a criminal record, say, you're making this person up, he doesn't exist.
That's basically what happened. I will say this, the key prosecutor who argued it before the jury claims today that he did not know about Carlos Hernandez, but we do know that the co-prosecutor was familiar with Hernandez, had previously prosecuted Hernandez, and never disclosed, apparently, Hernandez's name or his background to the prosecutor.
This is something, I probably watch a little bit too many episodes of Law & Order on television at home, but it always amazes me that prosecutors would rather have the wrong man in jail than nobody in jail.
Exactly right. And you know, one of... there was a former prosecutor that's in our report, Sam Millsap, who was really responsible for pursuing the death penalty against the young man you mentioned, Ruben Cantu, who was 17 at the time. And it's extremely compelling because Millsap now, you know, told Dan Rather in an interview that he regrets having prosecuted Ruben Cantu for the death penalty. He goes as far as to say that the question is, should Ruben Cantu have been prosecuted at all, based on the fact that that single eyewitness testimony was tainted?
And it was also amazing to see this man, who was a lifelong proponent of the death penalty, now being against the death penalty.
Yes, and partly because of this case. It has so troubled him. And Sam Millsap now has been testifying before state legislatures around the country. He testified in New Jersey, has testified in Montana, and has testified internationally now against the death penalty.
We're talking to Steve Jimenez. He is the producer of Did Texas Execute Innocent Men?, a TV special with Dan Rather. These two young men, Ruben Cantu, Carlos de Luna, Hispanic men, is the system prejudiced? Is that something that you saw or thought about while producing the TV?
You know, we really looked at that, and we couldn't conclude that this was really racially based. One crime, the Cantu crime, took place in San Antonio. De Luna, the murder, took place in Corpus Christi. These are cities with large Hispanic populations. We didn't find that, but what I will say is, economically, of course, you know, you're dealing with young men who are relying on court-appointed counsel, you know, not a lot of money for, you know, investigation, and I would say the same thing happens when you get to the, you know, the appeals process, is that you're dealing with, you know, a system that these are not, this is not the million-dollar dream team.
Did these people have adequate defense at that time?
Well, you know, particularly with De Luna, when you look at De Luna's case, there were a number of things. I mean, particularly the existence of Carlos Hernandez. That defense attorney has since apologized to one of De Luna's surviving sisters, Rose Raton, basically saying, you know, he did the best he could at the time, but, you know,
he didn't even go out looking for Carlos Hernandez.
He did not go out looking for Carlos Hernandez. In the case of Ruben Cantu, and his former attorney does appear in the program, he's now a judge in San Antonio, Andrew Carruthers. And Andrew Carruthers also is haunted by this case because he makes a very strong case that there was no physical evidence, and that the only thing that tied Ruben Cantu to this crime was the eyewitness testimony of a man named Juan Moreno. And Juan Moreno now says that the police had pressured him. Let me say this. Juan Moreno at the time was a 19-year-old illegal immigrant, and the police questioned Juan Moreno a few times and showed him photo lineups a couple of times, and he could not identify Ruben Cantu. One of the police officers in the case had Juan Moreno brought down to the station, and it was at that time that Juan Moreno finally identified Cantu and was told by the police that Cantu had been involved in another crime. So, again, the taint was there.
We're talking to Steve Jimenez. When a program like this goes on television, what kind of effect does it have? What kind of responses have you gotten so far?
Mary Charlotte, it's fascinating. In some ways, this was my first experience working with high-definition television, but the whole means now of how audiences view television, it's really changing radically. And this is a situation where instead of one broadcast, there are over a dozen broadcasts of this program on HDNet. The program is also available on the internet. So there's been a lot of blogging. It's just been picked up on sites all over the country. So that's been fascinating, that the means of distributing a program like this, it's just changing, and how people talk about the program is changing. So it's been new for me, dealing with, you know, my last big program for ABC News was done in the conventional manner, where it was a single broadcast, and people either saw it or didn't. But this is a situation where I'm getting emails still every day because the program, people are seeing it.
Very interesting. So why is a show like this broadcast so many times? That particular network needs to just fill out its hours?
Well, first of all, HDNet is relatively new, but there's a really serious commitment on the part of the founder, Mark Cuban, to really, you know, making HDNet a major player, you know, as big as HBO, Showtime, or anyone else. So,
and it's only for people with high definition television.
Yes, but when you think about it, that's where we'll all be 2 years from now. The entire industry is moving towards high definition. It's just this is a little bit out on the edge.
I haven't bought a television in what 10 years. It's the same machine. It'll probably be the same machine 10 years from now. But maybe you're right. But in any case, I think one of the things that's interesting about that is people are seeing this program on a big screen, on a high-definition screen. They're seeing the faces of these very young men. It probably has a greater effect just because of the visuals.
Yeah. One of the things that was a little difficult with this program is that, of course, doing high-definition for the first time, I wanted to go out and shoot, wonderful pictures. But because the crimes happened in the 1980s, I found when I went back to the neighborhoods in San Antonio and Corpus Christi, the things had really changed. That in one case where the crime scene had taken place in Corpus Christi, the gas station was no longer there. I found a pile of rubble when I got there. So I really had to rely a lot on crime scene photos, on previous news photos, etc. So we really couldn't show off high definition in the way we would have liked, but it is true. It's an immediate medium. I mean, you feel very, very close to the subjects.
So this program is called Did Texas Execute Innocent Men? And for people who don't have that access to HDNet, you can go to on the internet, hd.net/DanRather. And there it is.
There it is.
Are you going to keep working with Dan Rather?
I hope so. I'm looking at maybe doing another story with him now. I don't know if you saw the news yesterday that Dan has just sued CBS for $70 million. So we'll see. But
if he wins that, he'll have a budget.
it was really a great pleasure working with him. He's a consummate journalist. And it was inspiring working with Dan.
Steve Jimenez, thank you so much for being with us on KSFR.
A great pleasure.
Steve Jimenez is journalist and producer of Did Texas Execute Innocent Men, which is on HDNet. And you can go to hd.net/DanRather on the internet. We're going to take another little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Dear Diary. Stay tuned. And I would like now to welcome Elaine Pinkerton and Barbara Mayfield. They are two of the participants in the upcoming performance this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Film Center here in Santa Fe called Dear Diary. It's a benefit for the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome, ladies.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Dear Diary, what's that all about? Please tell me you didn't go back to your own diaries and you're reading them aloud.
Oh, no. When do we break it to her, Elaine?
These are the real things. Some are appalled, some are fascinated.
Elaine Pinkerton is holding her childhood diary, which has a little lock on it, those very effective locks that keep your parents out. And it is full of actual writings of, how old were you when you started writing that in this tiny-weensy script?
I started it at 13, and this is a 5-year diary. I was 13 through,
18 would
yes.
be the, the mathematics.
I've delved through every single page of every single day. Actually, they're small pages, and I find things in them. A letter to Armstead, he was a heartthrob. A movie stub ticket, 35 cents to go to the movies. All kinds of things. Ticket to the Four Freshmen.
Mary Charlotte, we have to tell you that Elaine, it's turned out, was really quite the boy crazy girl.
Just about every diary reader was.
Okay. Yes, in this group, a lot of boy craziness. It's amazing.
At what age?
Babes.
At what age did your boy craziness start?
Well, the diary starts at 13, and I liked Minor even then, but he wasn't as important as Armstead.
What about you, Barbara?
Well, you know, I was aspiring artist then, so I kept sketchbooks, not diaries. But when I went away to art school, a full 45 minutes away from home, okay, my little sisters wrote to me, and I've saved their letters. So I'm going to be reading my sister Marianne's letters from when she was 14 to me in college. And I brought a few. And see, here they are, the real thing.
So letters are part of the Dear Diary reading.
Yes.
How is it that letters count?
You know, correspondence, for me, it's still the written word, and they do totally portray, you know, our lives at that time. And that's how we managed to do this, because the whole thing of writing, correspondence, and the diaries, there's some... Elaine, elaborate. This is your baby.
Well, letters are our form of journaling. People don't write long mm-hmm. letters anymore, and diaries are a sort of interior memoir, and Barbara's just so much fun and so entertaining. We had to have her.
I couldn't read my sketchbooks.
Now, did you keep a diary yourself that had words in it besides your sketches?
No. Mm-mm. If I did, it's a complete blur and has faded into oblivion. So, I remember receiving a diary at like when I was maybe 9 or 10, and I think I did it that for a little while, but I have no idea where that is.
Well, I have to admit to our radio listeners out there, I have my diaries from the age of 9 years old on, and they say, you know, great passages of prose like, I went to school, I came back.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, that's why we didn't invite you to be part of this.
Yeah. What kind of, well, first of all, is this all ladies that are in the Dear Diary performance?
Men could be in it, but we haven't met any men who kept diaries.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Is diary, is it sort of a ladies' form?
Gosh, this sounds like we could get a grant and to get a study going on this.
I think that's an interesting question to investigate.
Mm-hmm. So far, it does seem to be that young girls keep diaries.
Now, are you and the ladies who are in this performance focused primarily on the teenage years?
We are indeed. Teenage diaries.
And how many women are reading?
We have 6 in all. And Maura Studi has graciously agreed to be our moderator, the actress and jazz singer and drama coach. She's just back from New Zealand, so... But she is going to be there on Sunday the 23rd at the Santa Fe Film Center, formerly Cinema Cafe. And we'll each be reading for maybe, 8 to 10 minutes. There's some wonderful music at the beginning.
There's refreshments and a reception afterwards.
And door prizes, which are diaries.
Door prizes are amazing. 17 door prizes.
Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking about the refreshments. when you went over the, putting this together, you're putting together essentially a performance. Did you try to make sure that the passages that people are reading are pretty varied?
We did. Actually, we've been working on this for, two months, and we critiqued one another. It wasn't immediately obvious what we wanted to read.
So how did you choose?
It was completely idiosyncratic, completely intuitive. We just gave each other feedback, and Barbara reminded me she liked the Christmas Eve part, so I put it back in. I had taken it out.
The Christmas Eve part.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to miss that.
We don't want to miss that, and we also don't want to give away the whole performance now, but we do want you to read some of your diary entries, if you don't mind.
No, of course not. You need to know, too, that each diary turned out to be so utterly different. It was astonishing. Everybody's personal style was right there, even at age like 13, 14, 15.
Very really interesting.
Amazing. Yeah, completely. And there's diary from each decade since from the 1950s onward.
Do you still, Elaine, keep a diary? Did you keep it all through your adulthood?
Every single day. I have books and books.
No. Do you go back and read them?
I am now. I'm working on a memoir about being adopted and that the effect on me. And so I obviously can't spend every day of the rest of my life reading them, but I am going through them because after I'm gone, no one will, probably not be interested. So I thought, why write them if I'm not going to harvest them somehow?
That is a question of why people write their diaries. And I've wondered this myself because I kept one for many, many years. And I thought, I don't really want to ever reread this, and I don't want anyone else to ever see it. So, you know.
I can't read every single word, but I'm trawling through, and I'm realizing that the world within actually has some wisdom.
Oh, really?
And it's rather refreshing to go back even beyond the teenage years and look at insights. So it's a fast trip. It's sort of a drive. Fly-through trip.
A drive-by trip. We're talking to Barbara Mayfield and Elaine Pinkerton, and the performance is on Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Film Center called Dear Diary. Let's hear some entries from diaries and letters.
I'd like to read June 18th, 1957. I'm in 7th seventh grade, eighth grade, and a teacher took us to Havana, took the bus through Key West, then boarded SS City of Havana. I met the nicest Cuban man. Kay Childers and I became good friends. This man kept telling me how beautiful my eyes were. The Hotel Plaza is beautiful. Already, I love Havana. June 19th, I'll read one more day. I love Havana! Our hotel room has an open balcony. Cuban food is out of this world. We took buses to go every place. Cuban males sure stare at us. We went out to Chandler College. The boys really like girls here. At night, we went to graduation. It was beautiful.
The Boys Really Like Girls Here by Elaine Pinkerton. Now, that's an interesting thing for a, 15-year-old to write? How old were you at that
14.
Point? 14-year-old to write. Did the boys really not like girls in Key West?
I went from North Carolina.
Ah.
But it was just that they were exotic to us, you know. And we discovered many other things. We went to cathedrals and buildings. We bought silver bracelets and castanets. But it was really about the boys.
Do you find yourself, when you reread those, remembering the actual day, remembering the texture and feeling and uniqueness of that day?
Actually, I do, because we've been dwelling in the past. We are mad, wacky diary and letter readers, and so I do. It's really refreshing. It's fun.
Barbara Mayfield, you've got some letters from your little teenage sister who wrote to you when you were in college.
That's right.
Let's hear one.
Here it is. This was in 1970, I think the fall, Monday night. I write slanted, ha-ha. Dear Barb, I hope you don't miss your toothbrush too much. Well, anyway, here it is. Today, Freddie finished painting the dining room ceiling, and I started washing the glue off the walls. Are you still going to make Mom the fruit basket? I hope so. I'm trying to find something to make. I feel like carving out an exotic design from wood or weaving a basket. It's so weird. I just have to keep doing something with my hands. Ag! Can you see? There,
I see the egg.
The egg. Can you suggest anything for me? The snow is almost gone. I want to plant my seeds. I hope I'll see you soon and get to bed early. Goodbye. Love. Marianne. P.S. I can't wait till summer. Beach, pools, air conditioning, heat. P.S. Gretel and Tarzan are okay.
Those being the cats?
That is the rabbit and the bird.
Good heavens. Barbara Mayfield and Elaine Pinkerton talking about Dear Diary. I think of this as maybe tools for fiction writers. Like if you become a writer, you would refer to these just simply to get style that people of certain ages write in.
One of our readers, Janet Guggenheim, who planned to be here but couldn't, it has a little mystery plot in her reading. It's absolutely delightful. She is a writer, author of several children's books and work on another. So yes, indeed.
A mystery plot?
In her diary.
What do you mean?
When she was 13. She tells about it. Come to the performance and find out. I don't want to give it away.
The mystery will not be revealed here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So all of this is a benefit for the Santa Fe Film Festival, which is in December, which we always feature on this show, which is a wonderful event. And the event has not only Elaine Pinkerton and Barbara Mayfield, but also Cindy Bellinger, Tammy Stagg, Deborah Finkelstein, and Janet Guggenheim. It's at 3 o'clock on Sunday, this Sunday, at the Film Center, moderated by Mara Studi. And
no reservations required.
No reservations required. Thank you, ladies, so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary
Thank
Charlotte.
You.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. Features Artist of the Month, Michel Camilo. performing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be here, of course, and all sorts of other good things on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. So we will see you then. Keep your dial tuned to 90.7 FM, 101.1 FM, and KSFR.org. Hasta la vista. Ciao.
Adios, Mary Charlotte.
Bye.